Over the years, one of the things that Carol and I, or two of the things that Carol and I feel very strongly about in relation to, I don't need that. Well, yeah, I do too. In relation to this whole subject of marriage, that we feel are essential in the development of any good relationship between a husband and a wife, is number one, we've got to work at it, and number two, we've got to develop a relationship with God that is warm and intimate and caring on a daily basis. And as we talk to you this morning and tonight and tomorrow morning, those two things are going to enter into everything that we say. And, you know, sometimes we'll be talking to married couples and we'll mention this matter of working at it. And they'll come back to us later and they'll say, hey, now, this week, every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, we've got an hour to spend with each other. How can we work at our relationship? Well, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about giving marriage a priority in our lives to the point where it becomes part of everything that we do, that we are working constantly at our relationship because we have put it very high up on our priority list. And that is one of the issues that we see as we travel around the country and interact with married couples as one of the difficulties in the relationships that we run into today. Now, I know in talking to a group like this that there are many of you sitting here, you've got a terrific thing going, you've been working at this thing called marriage for many, many years. Some of you here are older married couples than we are. I mean, you've been married longer than we have, and we're going on 39 years. We celebrate our 39th wedding anniversary this September. But the thing that Carol and I have learned is that no matter how long we've been married, there is always something else to be learned. There is always some other little thing that we can plug in to the development of our relationship that will be meaningful and real and will add spark and vigor and vitality to our relationship. And we're still doing that. We're discovering new things about each other all the time. And probably one of the reasons for that is that all of us are constantly in a state of change. We're growing, we're developing, and we're becoming different people. Dr. David Hubbard, the president of Fuller Theological Seminary, made a statement about marriage that I really like, and I think it hits it right on the head as far as this matter of priority is concerned. He says, marriage does not demand perfection. It's a good thing, huh? But it must be given priority. It is an institution for sinners. No one else need apply. But it finds its fullest glory when sinners see it as God's way of leading us to His ultimate curriculum of love and righteousness. Now, leave it to the president of a seminary to put marriage in the context of the classroom. It's God's ultimate curriculum for love and righteousness. But I think Dr. Hubbard's got a point. And as we look back on our relationship and the development of it over the years, that has been a big part of it. We're in a classroom every day in terms of this thing called marriage. Proverbs 27:17 says, iron sharpens iron, and one person sharpens another. And what that verse means, it's talking about two people whose lives rub together over a period of time. And if we are open to one another, we can learn from each other. And what a beautiful picture of marriage if we're willing to be open to each other. Because each of us, as a husband and a wife, we bring strengths and weaknesses into this relationship. And I hope that our goal would be to become a better person as we develop in our relationship and to capitalize upon the strengths of our mate and to try and diminish the weaknesses within ourselves. And so it becomes a growing process. And it's a lifetime project. Carol and I have come to the conclusion we feel that marriage is the greatest adventure that two people can ever embark upon. And we feel that way because we feel God has put us together as a married couple for some unique purposes. And one of those purposes is to make us into better Christians. better people. You know, it should be no surprise to us as believers that we come into marriage with significant differences between us, not as men and women, but simply as two people. One of the things that Carol and I discover and are still discovering is how different we are from one another. And also, we've discovered how much we are alike in certain areas. But it's not the ways in which we are alike that have created the problems. It's the ways in which we are different that from time to time have crept in and created the problems between us. I overheard someone last night at dinner commenting on My Fair Lady and Henry Higgins' marvelous statement in the midst of that musical. Why can't a woman be like a man? You remember, he gets so frustrated with Eliza Doolittle. And he finally comes out with that statement, only he made it a lot stronger than that. Why can't a woman be like a man? Well, there's some good reasons for that as to why she can't. And it's not just because she's a woman, but it's because primarily she's a different person. And he is a different person than you are, wives. And that's the way God planned it, believe it or not. And I believe in his unique way, in accordance with his perfect will for your lives and for ours, he eventually worked in such a way as to bring us together as a husband and a wife so that we could rub shoulders together, iron sharpening iron, for the rest of our lives. And of course, you know, when iron sharpens iron, there are other things that happen. For instance, when you take two pieces of metal and you rub them together, heat develops, huh? You ever had heat develop in your relationship? Well, we sure have. And sparks fly. But if you take two pieces of metal and you rub them together at exactly the right angle, they sharpen each other. And I believe that's part of God's purpose for marriage, is to hone us and sharpen us and make us into instruments that are fit for His kingdom and who are conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. And that's what he talks about over in 1 Corinthians 12. Listen, let me read you just a few verses from this passage. Now, when we normally think of this passage, it's in the context of the church. And we're sitting there on Sunday morning in this huge body of believers, and we think of this passage in relation to that group of people. But what I'd like to have you do this morning is switch gears with me and think of this passage in relation to marriage. Just the two of you as a husband and a wife. And there's just a couple of principles I want to draw from this. Now, the body is not made up of one part, but of many. Verse 14. 1 Corinthians 12, beginning with verse 14. Now, the body is not made up of one part, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason cease to be a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason cease to be a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? You beginning to get the picture? I mean, what are you as a husband, as a wife? Are you an ear, a finger, a foot, a nose? See, we're different. That's what he's saying here. And those of us in this room, and I assume that's everybody here, are part of the body of Christ. And so, as a part of the body of Christ, he's talking about us right here. As a husband, as a wife. Verse 18. But in fact, now listen to this, God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as He wanted them to be. He's wired you together internally, just the way He wanted you to be. He's wired your spouse together, just the way He wanted them to be. And then, through the mechanics of His will, brought you together as a husband and a wife, and now He wants you to live with that the rest of your life. And make it work for you rather than against you. That's the beautiful thing. See, He's arranged it, and we get to that down later in the passage, the matter of making it work for you rather than against you. Verse 19, if you were all one part, Where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts but one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. There's no way we can, as a husband or a wife, say of the other person, I don't need you. We need each other. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. The parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty, while our presentable parts need no special treatment. But God has combined the members of the body and has given greater honor to the parts that lacked it. Now listen to this. So that there should be what? No division in the body. Now project that into the context of marriage. Great diversity, but no division. That's the way we are, folks. That's the way Carol and I have discovered we are over the years. We're very different from each other. And yet God's goal for us is unity, to become one. And that doesn't mean just in the flesh. It means one in heart, in spirit, in goals, in objectives, of feeling with each other. No division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. What a beautiful picture of marriage. Now, I mentioned that Carol and I have discovered that we are quite different. And over the years, we're still discovering those things. And the thing that we have to work at is taking those differences and making them work for us rather than against us, from turning them from problems into possibilities, taking them from becoming liabilities and turning them into assets. And folks, that takes working at. That takes this iron sharpening iron thing. It's part of the working process. A few years back, 4 or 5 years ago, we were in Scotland. And we had had a 10 days of ministry there, 2 weekends, and then the weekend between. And we'd had a fantastic time with a group of Scottish couples. We'd been in many of their homes during the course of the week. And then we ended up the time there over on the west coast of Scotland at a weekend conference with a group of these couples. And we'd gotten to know a number of them over the time that we had been in Glasgow. And so it was really a terrific and responsive time. We just had a great time together. I thought that we were speaking the English language, but American English and Scottish English is quite different, and we had a lot of fun just because of that. Well, Sunday afternoon, the thing was over, and we had rented a car, and we were going to spend a week vacation doing Scotland. We brought our golf clubs along, and so we were packing up the car there at the conference grounds on Sunday afternoon, loaded everything off, started out, got off that evening to a little hotel we were going to stay, walked around to the back of the car and tried to get the door open. It was a station wagon type of thing. And I couldn't get it open. I got up on the bumper and I pulled with both hands on it and I couldn't get the door open. So finally, in desperation, I opened the back door of the car over the back seat and hauled out our suitcases and hauled them into the hotel. And then the next morning, same thing in reverse. And then the afternoon we stopped to play golf and I had to get the golf clubs out that way. Well, I lived with that for about 2 days. And then the third morning, we were checking out of a little hotel. And I asked the guy behind the desk where in town we might go to get this car fixed. And he told me a little garage down the road. And so we went down there. And I talked to the mechanic, showed him what was wrong, and I asked him if he could fix it. And he said, yeah, I think so. Well, I said, how long is it going to take? He said, about a half an hour. So Carol was standing there listening to all this. And across the street was a beautiful little church, an abbey. And she loves stuff like that. And I said, honey, why don't you go across the street, look the church over, come on back in a half an hour, and we'll be ready to go. So she did. Well, the guy got the car fixed. And I, of course, once I had got that door open, I mean, man, I was in Fat City. I just wanted to get everything straightened out because it was a mess. And so I was straightening out the luggage and the golf court clubs and getting everything in order. And Carol comes back across the street and sees what I'm doing, and she says,
why don't you leave that till later?
Because I want to straighten it out now.
Well, don't get mad at me.
Well, you always argue with me. And she walked away. Now, we only exchanged four sentences. I said to and she said to. But in those four sentences, we violated three basic principles of interpersonal relationships. I mean, now you've really got to work at that. I mean, three out of four, you know. That takes some doing. Well, I'll finish the story and then come back and tell you about those principles. We finally climbed in the car, started off down the road, and as you can imagine, it was a little quiet for a while. Neither of us said much. Well, about 5 minutes went by, and Carol began to chuckle, and then I began to laugh. And we were laughing at ourselves for this dumb stunt that we had pulled back here at the garage, because it really was stupid. Now, I don't know where you're at in your relationship in terms of being able to laugh at yourself, but believe it or not, folks, you are a very funny person. You may not really want to buy into that concept, but you are. You pull some very funny things that are dumb, and your family looks at you, and they want to laugh. Do they have the freedom to laugh? I think that's maybe part of the issue. Do they have the freedom to laugh? Have you learned how to laugh at yourself when you pull some dumb thing? Well, we need to develop that. And by that time, we'd been married about 35 years, and we had learned to laugh at ourselves by then. And we knew what we'd done. Well, we talked about it a little while, what had happened back there. We kind of analyzed it. And as a result of that analysis, it helped us realize what we had done. That had been wrong, that had been detrimental to our relationship. And hopefully learn from it. Now, as we analyzed it, here's what we discovered. The first thing that we did was the first word out of Carol's mouth. You remember what it was? When she came back across the street and saw what I was doing, you remember what she said?
Why
are you doing that now? Now, how many of you really enjoy being asked a why question under those circumstances? I don't see any hands going up. I think you're pretty much like we are. We just, that really rubs us the wrong way. You know, you're pulling out of the drive, you're driving and someone is sitting in the front seat next to you, I won't say who it is, and you pull out of the driveway and make your right turn, and they turn to you and they say, why are we going this way? Or you've just come down on Sunday morning and you've gotten all dressed up for church and you've gotten on what you consider to be your favorite sport coat and tie and everything matches just right. And your wife looks at you and she says, why are you wearing that tie with that coat? Lovely, huh? Now, you see, when people do that to us, the fact is they are not really asking a question, are they? They're making a statement, even though it's couched in the form of a question. It starts out with why and ends with a question mark. It's really a statement. I mean, why are we going this way is not really a question. It's really saying, if I were driving, we would not be going this way. Or if I had my choice, you wouldn't be wearing that tie with that sport coat. Or Carol was saying, if I had my way, we wouldn't be messing around with the luggage and the golf clubs now. Why questions intimidate us? We put our defenses up, and that's exactly what happened to me. You remember my response? Because I want to straighten it out now. Now, you know, if I'd said, well, sweetheart, I feel that now is a good time to get this mess straightened up in a soft voice, you know, quiet. Probably nothing would have happened from then on. She says, well, don't get angry about it. Where did she get the impression I was angry? Well, it was not so much what I said as the tone of my voice, wasn't it? See, we communicate more by how we say something, usually, than by what we say. The inflection of our voice, the tone of our voice, body posture. So, we need to be careful of why questions. And you know, why questions like that. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about why questions where you're seeking honest information, like why is the sky dark at night? You know, I don't know the answer to that question, but that's a legitimate question seeking information. But when we use why questions, where we really are threatening the other person, where we're really questioning their intelligence, because that's what boils down to a lot of times, or their choices, which is another thing it boils down to a lot of times. When we find ourselves using why questions in that way, fairly frequently, it's a pretty good barometer of our acceptance of the other person. And if we're using why questions a lot, then we are not really accepting the other person in a lot of areas of their life. The way they are, the way they do things, the way they think, the way they act. So we need to be careful of that. Okay, the second thing that we did that was really wrong, other than, you know, my getting a little angry, and then Carol got angry, and, you know, we had the little blow-up, but was the last statement that I made. Do you remember what I said? She said, why are you doing that now? I said, because I want to straighten it out now. Well, don't get angry. And then I said what? You always argue with me. Well, now, she doesn't always argue with me. She just argues with me once in a while. But when we use superlatives like that, or extreme statements, or emotional-packed words, we are just baiting the other person to respond in a negative way. You know, the word always and never. We're human beings. None of us are that consistent, that we always do something or we never do something. And so to use them on the other person, we know better. We know it's not true. And yet we do it, and it just comes out sometimes. And we need to be careful of the use of those kinds of words that can draw angry responses from the other person. Now, the third thing that we did had not so much to do with what we said as to how we are different from each other. And this is one of the things that we discovered as we talked about this going along in the car after it was all over. Now, you see, why was I taking the time right then to straighten out the luggage and the golf clubs? Why was I doing that? Because of the way I'm wired together inside. I am a perfectionist. I know that there must be some of you in the crowd, and I feel sorry for those of you who have to live with one. Dear Carol, she's lived with one for over 38 years now. A perfectionist is someone who takes great pains and gives them to everyone else. And that pretty well describes it. You know, the philosophy of a perfectionist is, if you don't have time to do it right, wait until you do have time to do it right. Now, someone who is more of the bent of Carol, and over in that end of the spectrum, and I'll get to that in just a minute as to what that is, they don't look upon that as perfectionist. They have another word for it. They call it procrastination. And that drives some people right up the wall. Now, I am a perfectionist, or I think I can honestly say now, after 38 years of marriage to Carol, that I tend to be a perfectionist. That would be a more accurate description of me now. Carol is just the opposite of a perfectionist. I don't know whether you've ever thought about what is the opposite of a perfectionist or not, but I've given a great deal of thought to that. And I would say that Carol is not sloppy. Carol is fast. So I don't know whether you can picture that situation, going back to the car there in Scotland at the little garage. But see, she's coming back across the street, observes what I am doing. Now, what is on her mind? Fast Carol. Let's get going. What are we messing around with the luggage for? Good night. We got all of Scotland to conquer. Let's go. And so her response was, seeing what I was doing, why are you doing that now? The emphasis on now. And, of course, that is the thing that started the whole thing. So, you see, the thing that precipitated the argument or the conflict in the first place was not anything that was said. It was a difference between us and the way we view parts of life. I had a mess that I'd been living with for 2 days, and I had an opportunity now to straighten it out. I got the back door open. I could get at this stuff. I see some of you guys are identifying with me. She had a totally different view of that same situation simply because of the way we're wired together. Now, how do you make something like that work for you rather than against you? Huh? Well, one of the strengths that Carol brings to our relationship, because she is fast, is that I seldom ever have to wait on her. I mean, we're going out to dinner, or you know, last night coming over here, man, she was ready before I was. She's fast. It doesn't take her any time at all to do stuff. I mean, she whips out a meal, you know, she gets the house cleaned, it's done. Well, on the other hand, my perfectionist tendencies contribute a lot to our relationship in that planning. I love to plan. I love to solve problems. And so that's kind of some of the areas that I handle in our relationship. We travel 50 to 60% of the time now. I do all the planning for our trips. She didn't even have to worry about it. And to her, that's a blessing. To me, the fact that I don't have to wait on her is a blessing. So we've learned to make this work for us. Now, of course, there are things in this whole spectrum that, you know, you just learn to live with. For instance, when we first got married, you know, here was perfectionist Jack and fast Carol. And over the years, we have learned from each other. Iron sharpens iron, one person sharpens another, and as a result, we have changed. And we've grown closer together. I have actually come to the place as a perfectionist where I realize there are some things in this world that just have to get done. It doesn't make any difference how you do them. Upside down, backwards, forwards, just as long as they get done. Well, you know, that's a long way for a perfectionist to come. On the other hand, Carol has learned that there are some things in this world that it's better to slow down just a little bit and do it right the first time rather than to have to repeat the process a half a dozen times or have somebody come along and pick up the pieces afterwards. So, you know, we've grown, and we've grown, come closer together. I'd say in our relationship after 38 years, we're about there from way out here. That's a long way, baby. That's probably about all the progress in this area that we're going to make in this lifetime. But that's pretty good. Because there are still things that we just know it's better not to do together. For instance, we don't wash a car together. I don't know whether you can picture that or not, but you know, here's the car and Carol has her bucket and sponge and I have my bucket and sponge and we say go. And so we start in and Carol goes swish, 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 swish. And she says, I'm finished, and I'm still over here, you know, working on the front fender. And so it's inspection time now, right? Perfectionist? Yeah. So I go around, I look at her side. And I make some dumb statement like, you're finished? And, you know, then I end up with a bucket of water over my head or something. And so we don't wash cars together. We don't hang wallpaper together. I mean, there's just no way. I insist that the lines be straight up and down. And to Carol, it really doesn't matter. So there are certain things you just learn to live with, you know. Well, let me just briefly mention the second thing that we feel is absolutely essential. And then Carol's going to, I want to give you a little assignment to work on. Marriage is really a triangle for a Christian. It should be for all because that is the way God intended it. But it's the husband, the wife, and God. We all know that God was the inventor of marriage. He's the thing that dreamed up this wonderful thing that we call marriage. And you've never really read Genesis chapter 2, the last half of that chapter, read it out loud together and put yourself into that situation, you men as Adam and you gals as Eve. That's quite an exciting story, especially when you let your sanctified imagination run loose and just kind of imagine what could have happened and what were the emotions and what was really said in detail. Now, the Scripture tells us a little bit of what Adam said, but he doesn't give, the Holy Spirit chose not to give us all that was said. And I'm sure there were some things that were said and done, and maybe, I don't know, Adam probably even whistled when he saw Eve walk out of the bushes, you know. But he invented it. It was God's idea. And folks, because of that, he's got some tremendous things to say to us in this book about marriage. And not just in those passages that relate directly to marriage, but in any passage that relates to our walk with God, the development of our relationship with Him as a husband and our relationship with Him as a wife, and then passages that deal with interpersonal relationships on the horizontal as well as on the vertical. And that's what God wants us to do on a daily basis. He wants you as a husband and you as a wife to develop a relationship with Him that is warm and intimate. And of course, as you know, that's one of the reasons why the Navigators stress the area of discipleship. It's why we talk about things like the quiet time and scripture memory and prayer and Bible reading and Bible study. Because we know not only will it make you as a husband and you as a wife a better person, but it will draw you closer to God. And as you as a married couple individually draw closer to God, you automatically will draw closer to one another. It's inevitable. That's going to happen. And that's what's on God's heart. Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glory, glory in this, that he knows and understands me, that I am the Lord which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24. That's what's on God's heart for all of us as a married couple. He wants us to grow in our relationship with Him in order for us to get to know Him and understand Him better. But in so doing, we will get to know and understand one another better. We'll be drawn closer to one another. And so the challenge, part of the great challenge of marriage, is to get to know and understand one another better as a married couple. In the process of getting to know and understand Him. And so, with that in mind, that's what we want to spend the rest of the time with you on. But I, first of all, I want to give you just a little stand-up break and an assignment. And if you got your these little deals with you, by the way, Mike Hames did a fantastic job on these. If you could see what we normally use, it's just a little mimeograph sheet, but he got out his Macintosh computer and a laser printer, and man, he really did a fantastic job on this. But on page one, to understand each other, what I'd like to have you do right now is take about 3 or 4 minutes, take your pen out, or your pencil, and answer, write in answers to the first two. List ways in which you and your spouse are alike, to give, three or four. Ways that you're alike. And then item two, list ways in which you're different from one another. So just take time to do that individually right now. And then we're going to give you, in about 3 or 4 minutes, we're going to give you an opportunity to interact on that and compare your answers. Okay? Not much time.
That you all may want to continue with this afternoon if you take a hike in the beautiful surroundings here is continue on the one that we just gave you, the differences one. There's so many more things that I know you all relate to on that. The Bible describes marriage as two becoming one flesh. That's a beautiful picture of marriage, and Jack and I feel it means much more than the physical relationship. It means really becoming one in heart. One in goals, one in vision, becoming, as it were, best friends. But to become best friends is not easy. And it does take continual work. It takes at least three things. First of all, it takes the fact that God has got to help us. We have to know that we are complete in Him, that we're not two people who are parasites of one another, but that we are two complete individuals in Christ. And as we bring those two together, that we can relate to one another, complete one another, become more together as a couple than either one of us could by ourselves. But we have to know that our security, our worth, our significance is in God alone. And secondly, we have to know ourselves. I have to know Carol before I can explain Carol to Jack. And I don't know where you are on this, but there are many times that there are things going on inside of me that I don't even understand myself. I'm depressed or I'm frustrated. And what I have to do often is to go to God and say, help. To pray James 1:5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally, and it shall be given him. Oh, I hang on to that. And so I say, Lord, I don't even know what's going on inside of me. Help me to know what's going on inside of me so that I can explain me to Jack. And God does give us help, doesn't he? I have to be a student of myself. And so I study all these charts and I take all these tests to find out who I am. And I think at this age in my life, I'm grateful to know more of who I am than 30, 40 years ago. But thirdly, I have to study Jack. Now, as we're constantly changing and there's just so much to understand, you have to laugh and cry at the same time when we begin to study one another. I read this in Elizabeth Elliot's Discipline, the Glad Surrender. She said, a couple I know had been married only a week or two when the wife went out shopping. The husband wondered what he might do for her while she was gone that would please and surprise her and show her how much he loved her. A brilliant plan came to his mind. He got down on his hands and knees and scrubbed the kitchen floor. It was a demeaning task, in his opinion, and he felt exceedingly humble while performing it. How amazed Anne would be. He waited in eager anticipation for her return, thinking how blessed it is to give. She drove in the driveway, breezed into the kitchen, set the grocery bags on the counter, and glanced at the floor. Oh, the floor is clean. Thank you, honey, was all she said, and went about putting the groceries away. The man told me he went into a three-day funk. He was hurt. He was insulted. He was not properly appreciated. And the blessing of giving drained out in an instant because he had not received the kind of thanks he had expected. Anne had no idea what the trouble was. What she did not know was that her husband had never heard of a man's doing such a thing as scrubbing a floor for his wife, especially voluntarily, having thought of it all by himself. What he did not know was that in his wife's family, no woman ever did the job. Her father considered it a man's job and did it as a matter of course. Friends, our marriages consist of these things, don't they? And yet so often because we don't understand, we begin to go diverse ways. We need to understand. Proverbs 23. Is it 23? Yeah. Says 24, 3 and 4. Says, by wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established, and by knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. Wisdom and understanding. And yet, friends, let me ask you a question. You don't have to answer this out loud. But how many times in the last week have you prayed for more wisdom to understand that person that God has given you? How many times this last week have you prayed for more love? For a deeper, just adoring of that one? God is the author of love. And Charlie Shedd has said, true love has no maximum. And I love that. There are always new vistas ahead, aren't there? For our loving one another. And yet so often we just don't ask God to give us that love, that wisdom, that understanding that will cause our relationship to keep on growing. Ephesians 4:32 says in the Phillips, be kind to one another. Be understanding. Be as ready to forgive others as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven us. Three vital and important commands for any relationship, but especially a husband and a wife one. Be kind to one another. We are so often the least kind to those we love the most. Little poem goes, they were single and went walking, and her heart did skip a beat as she stumbled on the sidewalk. He murmured, careful, sweet. Now the wedding bells have rung. And when they walk the self-same street, when she stumbles on the sidewalk, he just yells, pick up your feet. Be kind to one another. Be understanding. A man once said, a long life is barely enough for a man and a woman to understand each other. And to be understood is to love. The man who understands one woman is qualified to understand pretty well everything. But the reverse is true. And yet when Adam was lonely, God made for him not 10 friends, but one wife. And I'm so glad. And then it says, be forgiving. Often this is where couples that you'll be working with need to start. Because we get hurt and we build a little tissue, a little wall, scar tissue around that hurt. And then we're hurt again and that wall goes a little higher. And again and again and again until that wall is so wide, so high, that we simply can't get through it. And we can't get through it. Only God can. But we have to start there at forgiveness, because it robs us of everything else if we aren't really forgiving of one another. And I think it was Mrs. Billy Graham who said that a good marriage is simply a union of two awful good forgivers. And that is true. One man said, when we quarrel, my wife gets historical. His friend said, don't you mean hysterical? He says, no, I mean historical. She brings up everything I ever did. And yet Proverbs says in the Living Bible, love forgets mistakes, but nagging about them parts the best of friends. But we want to get back to understanding, because there is so little understanding. One minister's wife said this, if I could give one piece of advice, and only one, to women, it would be this. Study your man. Study him as if he were some rare and strange and fascinating animal, which he is. Study his likes and dislikes, his strengths and weaknesses, his moods and mannerisms. Just loving a man is fine, but it's not enough. To live with one successfully, you have to know him. And to know him, you have to study him. Look around you and decide how many of the best marriages you know are ones where a wife, in a deep sense, actually knows her husband better than he knows himself, knows what pleases him, knows what upsets him, knows what makes him laugh or makes him angry, knows when he needs encouragement, knows when he's too charged up about something and needs to be held back, knows, in other words, exactly what makes him tick. Do you know your husband that well? Do you husbands know your wives that well? That is our assignment. That is our ministry. That is our goal in marriage, one of our goals. And yet, it's a constant process because, as Jack has said, we're always changing. Now, I'm going to explain to you just four differences between Jack and me. As he told you, these are not necessarily men-women differences. These are people differences. And you women may find yourself identifying with Jack. That doesn't mean you're masculine. And you men may find yourself identifying with me. It doesn't mean you're feminine. It just means you're different from us. And the only reason we're giving you these is for you to begin to do a lifelong study, if you haven't already, of who you are and who that person is that God has led you to, so that you can begin to complete each other. Now, some of the things that I'm talking about this morning, you may say, oh, we figured that out. That's great. But Jack and I are constantly still finding ways in which we're completing each other in these. What is the positive part of that? how can we really use that in glorifying God together? And maybe this will give you some ideas of how that can happen in your relationship. Jack is a very objective person. And I am a very subjective person. To Jack, a fact is a fact is a fact. He can take a detached view of things. To me, a fact is slightly more than a fact or slightly less than a fact, depending on what mood I'm in. I have a hard time being detached about anything. Now, the implications of this are really great in our relationship. Jack sees things very realistically. He sees the bigger picture. He can look to the future and think in concept form better than I can. It used to be that Jack would have a meeting in our living room and I'd be fixing coffee in the kitchen and suddenly the men would be disagreeing. I mean, they'd be really disagreeing. And I'd be stirring the coffee or something, and I'm thinking, oh, they're about to come to blows. Next minute, laughing, patting each other on the back, best of friends. That's his objectivity. However, I have also learned that should I say those very same things to Jack, he loses his objectivity. I have to know that. This comes in 100 different ways. Jack will say, the Joneses are busy and can't come tomorrow. And I'll say, I wonder what we did to offend them. Now, subjective people do not take teasing well. You who are objective, remember that. There is no way that Jack can come and say, hi, Chubby, that I don't take it personally. He knows that now. Jack is very essential-minded. I am very detail-minded. Jack focuses in on the main subject, the most important thing to be considered. And I see the detail. I see the minutia. Jack used to go away to a week-long conference. And he'd come home, and I would be staying home with our small daughter, the dog, the washing machine, dial a prayer. And so when he would come through the door, I would be starving for adult communication. And I would give him a great hug and a kiss, and I would say, honey, tell me all about that conference. And he would tell me all about that conference in 10 minutes flat. And I would think, oh, he doesn't care enough to tell me about that conference. And if he doesn't care enough to tell me about that conference, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. That's the way my mind works. It always goes back to how does he feel about me. On the other hand, I would start to tell him a story about the man down the street who, 3 years ago, he ran for state senate. Remember? He was the one who had that mother-in-law who, she ended up in the state asylum, and about this time, I'd look at Jack and his eyes would be sort of crossed, glazed over, and I would think, he's not listening. Oh, and I was right. And I think, if he's not listening, then he's not interested in what I'm interested in. And if he's not interested in what I'm interested in, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. Now, friends, I was wrong. I've cried buckets over this one before I understood. You see, when Jack told me all about that conference in 10 minutes flat, in his way, he had told me all about that conference. You see why? Zeroed in on the main point, the concepts, the most important thing to be considered. Now, he's adjusted. He realizes now that I need to hear about some of those really important things, who's going to have a baby and who got engaged and the best meal he had, you know, some of those important things. And so he tries to remember. On the other hand, I have learned to boil a juicy 4-hour story down to 10 minutes flat. But there are times when he's trained himself just to listen because he knows sometimes I've got to get it all out. And I love him for that. It's why lots of women need other women, however, to hear all those details. because it's very hard for some men to listen to all those details. I remember Lynn and I still going round and round on where we would pin a corsage on a dress that neither one of us had. And I, about that time, I thought, I wonder what Jack would think about this conversation, you know. Now, essential, detail-minded people are distracted by and impressed by the little things, the accidental and incidental. This drives the essential-minded people right up walls sometimes. Jack will say, that's a good-looking car, but how does it run? That's the essential. I would say, I just don't like the color. Jack would say, I like that speaker's ideas. And I'll say, did you notice that his shirt matched his tie? Now, I'm exaggerating, but not much. It isn't that I didn't notice the speaker's ideas. It was just that I noticed a detail, too. Not wrong, my friends. Just different. Remember that. Not wrong. Just different. I'll show you how this fits together in the next one. Because the third thing is that Jack is a very logical person, and I am a very emotional person. Jack is inclined to study the evidence and in a step-by-step reasoning process reach a conclusion. I rely on my intuition, my instinct, my emotion to reach a conclusion. Many times the same conclusion. And my way's faster. Yes, it is. Now, let me show you how these can begin to dovetail. Someone has suggested that a person who has intuition, it's really goes back to the mind for detail. And I think this is probably true. We can go into a situation and notice two completely different sets of things. Marriage has been described sometimes as it's like two people who, we have two eyes, rather. We have two eyes to see things from a slightly different point of view. When you only have one eye, you see things flat. But when you have two eyes, you see things in the round. Well, see, that's what marriage is. Two people seeing things from a different point of view so that you see things in the round. You get dimension. So Jack and I go into a situation, see two different things. I am aware of 20 little details. I'm aware of the body posture. I see that raised eyebrow. I hear that tone of voice. All of these things filter through that my computer of my mind, and it comes out an intuition, a feeling, if you will. So when we come out of a situation, often Jack will say, how did you feel about that situation? I cannot tell him what I have observed. I just tell him how I feel. He filters that through his very objective grid. We can go back into that situation, ask some other questions, and we come out with a picture in the round. I think that's a beautiful way that God has allowed us to come together on this. But we're still learning. This has been one, my friends, that in a sense, I have to admit, I have resented a little bit over the years. I have thought sometimes, why doesn't Jack get more involved? Why doesn't he just jump right in emotionally the way I do? Well, just last month, I had occasion to say, thank you, Lord, that you have made Jack different from me on this one. We had a very difficult situation that was kind of an ongoing situation and a very distressful situation a month ago. And my circuits got overloaded. My emotional circuits got overloaded. And I looked down inside of me and there just was just nothing there left emotionally. We had 2 weeks of family conferences. We were right in the middle of it. And Jack said, honey, you've got to detach yourself from the situation. And before I could even say, how am I going to do that? He said, when this person calls, just say, let me let you talk to Jack. Well, I breathed a sigh of thankfulness to the Lord and to Jack. And I was going up the stairs. And I thought how wonderful it is to have a man who can detach himself and handle a lot more things and has the ability to to be the person that is responsible. And then I can kind of dump on him. And then I thought, but Lord, who does Jack have to go to with skin on? Yes, he can go to you and he talks it over with me, but boy, he's dad in a lot of situations. He's the one where the buck stops. And he doesn't have anybody that he can dump on that way. And then I thought, Lord, I am so grateful that you made this man and gave him the ability to handle multiple things because he is the logical one. And I can only handle one thing at a time because I just jump right in. And I am that emotional one that that is that way. So we're learning. Fourth, Jack uses speech many times to convey facts and ideas. I use speech often to express feelings and emotions. We're looking at a gorgeous moon, great big full moon, and I say, oh, isn't that a gorgeous moon? Well, what am I saying? I'm saying, oh, that moon makes me feel romantic. And if Jack comes back with, yes, that's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by, he actually did say that one time, but he laughed. He knew what I was saying. Now, it's raining outside, and I look outside and I say, oh, it's raining outside. Well, what am I saying? I could be saying a couple of things. I could be saying, oh, it's raining outside. That makes me feel depressed. Or I could be saying, oh, it's raining outside. That makes me feel energetic. I'm going to clean house like crazy. The chances are I am expressing a feeling. Jack looks outside. He says, it's raining outside. Well, what is he saying? The heavens have parted and little drops of moisture are falling to the ground. He is expressing a fact. I am expressing a feeling. This was a hard one for us to come to grips with, but a very vital one. I can remember just as I was studying this one about my husband, I backed the car out of the garage one day and I backed a little too hastily and I took a piece of the garage with the back fender. And I came in and I said, oh, I feel awful. You just can't imagine what it was like when that car went crunch. And Jack stopped me just like that. And he said, never mind that. What happened? Oh. My first thought was, he doesn't care. He doesn't care how I feel. And if he doesn't care how I feel, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. But you see, my next thought was, no, that's not true. Jack is interested in my feelings. He just needs the facts first. And that's okay. Where are you? Have you really learned to blend on this, to understand? So much to understand. One of the things recently that we've been thinking about is the languages of love. Some of you may have heard about that. But many counselors are telling us these days that the primary thing that we need to do is, as we get married, is to learn the partner's language of love. In other words, if you don't learn the primary way your mate is expressing love, often you reject that one, and so you don't build all the secondary languages of love that will forge you together. Now, what do I mean? Well, one counselor suggests five different languages of love that are primary. I've added three. Words. Have you ever heard you men, some of you say, wonder why your wife is saying, tell me you love me. Do you love me? Their primary language of love may be just that they need to hear it in the words. Another one is touch. For many of us, touch is even more important than words. Another one is time. And how many times I've heard wives say, my husband works his head off, but he doesn't spend time with me. And she's not hearing love. That is her primary way of hearing love. Another is gifts. Some husbands are very good at giving gifts. And that may be what they want. That is what their language is. Another is doing things, deeds. And that would be the husband who is working his head off to support his wife. But his wife may not be hearing that at all because she wants the other ways. Jack and I have added loyalty. In fact, probably this is the way Jack hears love more than any other way. He needs to know that I am 100% with him. I don't mean we don't talk about everything, and I don't mean that I don't disagree with him sometimes. But when we've made a decision, he needs to know that I am with him. And there have been times in our lives when he's looked at me and said, "Honey, are you really with me in this?" And I've realized that I have not communicated love because he has not heard me say and feel that I'm really with him. The way I hear love is his acceptance of me. I'm kind of a nut, and I know it. And I have maybe 99 kind of far-out ideas for every one that's pretty good. And yet, to my knowledge, I can never remember Jack saying, "Honey, that's got to be the dumbest idea you ever came up with." He may have thought it, but he's never said it. And so I feel Jack's acceptance. And when I feel Jack's acceptance, I feel love. Another little one that you may want to put into the hopper. I hope you're always reading. There's a little book out called Passive Men, Wild Women. The author has also written another one called Thank God It's Monday. His whole premise, he's a secular therapist and psychologist, but he has a very interesting theory that I think has a lot of merit to it. He says that in a relationship that most men, when they've worked hard all day, when they come home, they want to drop out for a time. They want to drop out of the relationship. They want to drop out of the kids. They want to drop out of life for a time. Most women, regardless of whether they're working outside the home, when they come home, they want to drop in to that relationship. They want the intimacy. The husband needs distance. And this man, even though he works with a lot of businessmen, and he calls this a man-woman problem. It may not be yours. But it's worthy thinking about because he says that he sees many divorces simply because a woman presses a husband to drop in when he is needing time alone to drop out. And so what she needs to do is just to give him a half hour, 45 minutes, to do that, to have that alone time, and then his unselfishness to come in, to drop back into that relationship. Do we know that about each other? Are you aware of that when you're counseling other couples? Just another thing, another difference. I'm just going to read in closing Romans 15, 5 to 7. And I've changed it slightly from the New International Version to apply it specifically to couples. Because, oh friends, we need to understand. We need to pray and ask God for that kind of understanding, that kind of creativity and wisdom that only he can give. See, there often I will pray, "Lord, show me how this difference in us can really work for us, can really be something I'm thankful for instead of an irritant in our relationship." And this is what Romans 15 says. "May the God who gives endurance and encouragement give you a spirit of unity as a couple, as you follow Christ Jesus, so that with one heart and mouth you may glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Accept one another then, just as Christ accepted you, accepted and understood, in order to bring praise to God."